Hello and welcome back to The Shift of Land. I'm Sarah Parker. The Shift of Land is a 13-part series which focuses on the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in New Mexico. This week we will look at how our situation with water is changing in New Mexico today and what that means for culture in the state. In an arid region, the sacredness and importance of water is probably even more intense in culture just for the simple human need for water. New Mexico has long traditions of water sharing.
Well, let me start with the custom. There's an old custom in New Mexico that most Spanish-speaking peoples, but as well as Pueblo peoples, as well as some peoples on the border, are familiar with. And you don't see it so much anymore, though people of my generation are familiar with it. It's not as widely practiced as it used to be, except under certain circumstances, that an elder asks a younger person, a child, for a glass of water. Hijo or hija, tráeme agua. And the young person's supposed to drop whatever they're doing and go and fetch a glass of water, hand it to the elder, and stand there politely and respectfully, arms folded, while the elder drinks the water, however long they may take, and then hands it back to the youth and then blesses her or him. In my book, I take this as a really significant custom because this custom shows, first of all, the proper comportment between juniors and elders. But the fact that it also involves water, I think, shows that there is a kind of reverence for water that's connected to respect between generations.
University of New Mexico professor of anthropology, Dr. Sylvia Rodriguez, explains the concept of respeto, respect, and how it is so connected to the water and the culture of New Mexico.
And the whole idea of respect, or respeto, respeto involves a whole complex of values that doesn't necessarily just translate so well into the English respect. It's a way of treating people that involves relations between generations, relations between the genders, relations between neighbors, relations between kin of different kinds. That is a way of acting honorably. And there are all kinds of ways in which honor is defined. Certainly, you see this in traditional Mexico. You see it in northern New Mexico. You see it in other parts of the world. But there's a whole ethic that underlies this value system that I believe ties into the moral economy of water, as I've talked about in my book, is that what underlies the principle that water must always be shared. You mustn't hoard it to the extent that someone else goes without. Because, of course, no one would survive if you did this, ultimately, in an arid environment. But that there is an ethic, that the ethic of sharing water reaches into other aspects of social relations. And the principle of treating people with proper respect is part of that. It's part of this whole cultural fabric. I once had a student who had, I thought, a really important insight. She was a Mexican-American student who had gotten an argument with her mother about respect. There was this generational difference. The young woman had grown up in a city. The mother was more traditional. And the young girl, who was very American in her orientation, said that respect was something that you earned as an American. And her mother insisted that respect is something that you owe as a proper person. And I think that's a subtle difference there, is that a person deserves respect. And a person gets as much respect, of course, as they give someone else.
Water in the West is scarce, but for centuries it's been here for people who have lived with it, taken care of it, and shared it. It's been here as a human need and right rather than a commodity. Today, however, with a population increase and environmental changes, the water has become more valuable to the market and more precious than ever to agriculture and people. In New Mexico, we see water with a priority of time. Therefore, the people who were here before anyone else are allowed first dibs on water. So the Pueblos have senior water rights over all others, and as time and history go, so does the level of senior and junior water right. This makes sense. When the Spanish, Tlaxcaltecans, and Mestizos came from Mexico, they had to work with the Pueblos, who had for generations maintained water systems of catchment and irrigation. Today, with the increase in population and development, and with a shift of perspective, water is being seen as a commodity rather than a basic right. This is happening globally.
Yes. Hi, my name is John D'Antonio, New Mexico State Engineer.
The Office of State Engineer decides where all of the water goes in the state. It all has to be accounted for, as communities and our neighboring states in Mexico need a certain amount of water that flows through. New Mexico is in the middle of water adjudication, where who has what right of water is determined.
Sure. Water adjudications, in fact, and I have an outline. It's a pretty complicated process. It's somewhat akin to a ownership of a piece of property, in which you have clear title of a piece of property. You know who owned the property beforehand and where it happens. But in an adjudication process, actually, the state engineer or a judge comes in and they order a hydrographic survey, which means of a certain stream. So you go in and you look at the water uses within that particular stream. And then my office, actually, the staff reviews water rights records. We look at digital, what we call imagery and mapping of water use out in the field, and we analyze that use and verify land and ownership records. So in the adjudication process, after we look at the water rights records and we obtain that imagery and we start looking at the mapping and the water use and verify ownership information, then we field check. So we have staff that goes out there in the field. We use the survey. We look at all the irrigated tracts that have been claimed, and we take what we call a global positioning station, the instruments out there to verify where the land is, and talk to owners in the field. All this we input into an informational GIS system, and the hydrographic survey maps and reports are produced, and then they're sent over to the legal staff. What the legal staff does is they start preparing these proceedings that are started by the state and in some cases by the federal government or any other interested person, and there's a lawsuit that's filed, essentially. And that's why it becomes an adversarial process. The state files a lawsuit against the owners. We also give what we call offers of judgment, and we send to each individual owner what we feel is their water right based on all the information that we have, all the mapping, all the field checks, and all that information. What the water rights owners do, they have an opportunity to either challenge what we've established as their water right. They can also challenge others. They think maybe their neighbor got too much, so they can do that. And it's called the interstate process, and it's got that ability to do that. And then after all said and done, the judge would issue a final decree, and it defines all the water rights in that particular adjudicated area. So within New Mexico, we have about 12 active adjudications, and we have about 65,000 defendants, and it's all over the state of New Mexico. We've got adjudications going on everywhere. And the only what happens, the ultimate product out of that adjudication, it gives certainty to that water right owner exactly what amount of water rights they own, what their priority date is, what their points of diversions and places of use are. And so that really is the final step in determining a water right. Unfortunately, in New Mexico, we're only about 20% adjudicated. We're working on an additional 40%, and we're stretched pretty thin because a lot of it has to do with what a judge wants in a particular area, and they dictate what sort of resources we need to spend, and so we're kind of spread out and spread thin, and a lot of times that hydrographic information becomes stale and it's old information, and we have to do restudies.
I think adjudication is the only way to genuinely protect senior water rights. Including the prior and paramount rights, because by moving forward with transfers without adjudication, which is a legal process for determining the quantity and quality of a water right, you could be transferring water that isn't actually senior water and impairing more senior water rights. So until everyone has a date affixed.
This is Janet Jarrett. She comes from a dairy family in Los Lunas, south of Albuquerque. She's been on a number of different boards and deals with water and land issues.
And certainly the Middle Valley, well, all over the state, the dates run the rampant from, 1700s forward. Some of them are earlier, but harder to get the documentation for a wide variety of reasons, including churches burning, where a lot of the documents were stored. But I think that as long as you, until you have adjudication, every time there's a transfer, you're potentially taking someone else's water.
One of the problems with adjudication is that there is 4 times the amount of water permits in the state as there is water. Much of this has come over the years from other state engineers. It makes the whole process that much more difficult. John DeAntonio explained that New Mexico is expecting to grow by 85% in the next 40 years. Population and development are growing now. Drive down I-25 to Albuquerque from Santa Fe and you see developments that you swear weren't there the last time you drove through. We all need water. And where will this water come from?
Well, it's somewhat of a deceiving number, but you could take 10% of the water out of agriculture and accommodate a doubling of the state's population. And that's with a caveat in that we don't always have a full supply year. But in New Mexico, we use roughly about 4.4 million acre-feet of water. 75 or 76% of that is used in agriculture. You know, the next biggest user, which is interesting, is reservoir evaporation. That uses 10% of the water in the state. 9% of the water in the state is used through public water supply systems and domestic wells. And then only 3% is used for mining and power. And then 2% of the water used in the state is for commercial, industrial, and livestock use. And so when you look at those percentages, you say, well, water is probably going to come out of agriculture, but there's not a whole lot that has to come out of agriculture if we make sure that we do it right and just allow for the consumptive use and then just grow in the areas that we can accommodate that growth, because not every area is are those percentages consistent where you have 75% in ag and the rest in those other uses.
So this is where many agriculturalists have problems. Transfers are being made from agricultural lands to development. This is not happening quickly, as transferring your water means your land is dry and won't grow any crops. Even digging a well for a house can mean that you're double dipping into the state's water.
The first thing you have to ask when anyone tries to compare the water that ag uses with any other water use is, first, are they talking about consumptive use or direct diversions? Because ag will divert water, but then it returns it to the system where it's diverted again later, either by other agricultural users or it recharges domestic wells, municipal wells. So there's that water gets used over and over again, including by the environment, because our stream systems have endangered species. And so there are water requirements for those aquatic species that have to be met. And so the first thing is to determine whether or not you're talking about consumptive use or diversion. Then you have to think about, okay, well, 75%, that sounds like there's a ton of water out there. But if you look at where ag is actually occurring and where the other uses are occurring, they're not in the same place. The east side has a tremendous amount of agricultural land, under irrigation. But the stream systems seem to be where the population centers are, like Albuquerque and Las Cruces, those areas. And certainly in the Middle Rio Grande, in the Middle Rio Grande water planning region, which is Sandoval, Bernalillo, and Valencia counties, the ag water and urban water are almost identical in consumption, and they're about each one a third of the water, and the slightly larger third is actually riparian. So it's very deceptive to say that it's 75% of the water when the largest water consumer is Albuquerque, and it's already using as much water as ag is. So what happens when you think, oh, well, we'll just dye up 10% of the ag lands? What happens to the recharge? What happens to the environmental quality, the open space, the air quality, water quality, all those things that are enhanced by agriculture? What happens to that? And particularly in critical areas around urban centers where you're having a lot of the pollution occurring, it's very important to have that surrounded by the ag lands and the open space. And ag, when you're talking about the water that ag uses, you have to realize it's going to multiple purposes as well. It's not only recharging the aquifer for other uses that are domestic uses and urban uses. It's also providing water for compact compliance and endangered species act compliance. So those are things that are very important and overarching concerns, that if you dry up ag land, Are they really going to pump water from the wells into the river? Well, I guess they will. They did it on the Pecos, didn't they? But it'll be urban wells pumping.
The process that's used when you take water out of agricultural production, it's a permitting process, and it's really a voluntary process. If a city wants to continue to grow, they've got to make sure they have adequate water rights associated with their water use. We can use the city of Rio Rancho, for instance, which is really a pretty new city, but it's growing fairly rapidly. And they've got a permit with my office that requires them to have to acquire so many acre feet every 5-year period of time. And those water rights that they have to obtain, they really offset the groundwater pumping to the river. Because as soon as you take a gallon of water out of the ground, depending on how close you are to the river, it essentially affects the flow in the river. And so the requirements are that on a schedule, they take water and from some farm area somewhere, dry up that land, and they transfer the consumptive use over into the city's use.
You're listening to The Shift of Land, where we examine the connection between land, culture, and agriculture in the state. In this program, we're focusing on water. The transference process is voluntary, and a protest process does exist. And D'Antonio says that there are public protections in place.
To date, it's voluntary. For the most part, there have been certainly open threats of condemnation by municipalities to condemn water, because in New Mexico, water is a condemnable right. But municipalities have the power to condemn not only water, but springs, wells, and any other sources of water supply. And their jurisdiction is not limited to their planning and platting jurisdiction, which in towns that are 25,000 people or less, extends 3 miles beyond their municipal boundary. And if they're more than 25,000 people, their jurisdiction is 5 miles. If they're on a stream system and they have rights in that stream system, like diversion rights, for instance, either on the Rio Grande or the San Juan Chama project, their jurisdiction extends to any storage facility and any tributary thereof, which means that the municipalities along the Rio Grande can condemn water all the way to the borders of the state because of the tributaries and because the river comes from Colorado. So any municipality that has a San Juan Chama right, like Belen, Las Lunas, can condemn to the Colorado borders. Las Cruces has a surface diversion out of the Rio Grande, so they also have that power of condemnation. And additionally, not only can they condemn or acquire water for that distance, if there is an impaired water right because of that acquisition, they can condemn that impaired right as well. So I think most people don't realize that the municipalities have that far-reaching power to condemn. I mean, people don't think about them condemning a spring and capturing it and pumping it to the city, but they can do it. And they've talked about it. A few years ago, there was an issue of Las Vegas condemning the acequia rights in Las Vegas. And they can do that because a subdivision of the state can condemn the property of another subdivision of the state. There is no protection. And that's a big problem because it puts the large municipalities in the driver's seat because they have not only more financial resources, but could potentially demonstrate a greater need for their population in the smaller towns. And it isn't necessarily about condemning the water the smaller town already has, but more water in the area of the smaller town, so that small town will never be able to change or grow or maintain its citizens' vision of their lifestyle because that water's up for grabs by the downstream big city. The state engineer goes forward with a very lively water market all over the state by transferring water that's not adjudicated. There have been estimates of, you know, there's a difference between paper water and wet water. So there are estimates of 4 times as much water having been permitted as there is wet water available. And this has been made by former state engineers. And when you're talking about that much more water on permits, those permits, a lot of them were based on transfers. So how many times, you know, how far can you really stretch the wet water supply? So I would suspect that one of the reasons, particularly in the Middle Rio Grande, that the state engineer has avoided adjudication by trying to do things administratively or sort of do things administratively, is because when adjudication comes, there's going to be some invalid transfers have taken place because perhaps the water right didn't have an accurate history presented at transfer. Maybe different transfers were made out of political expediency, depending on who got it. I mean, there have been a lot of complaints that if you're trying to transfer water to a municipality, you're going to get a lot more attention and a faster result than if you're transferring it for any other purpose.
Jared explained that the Papadopoulos report showed that the Middle Rio Grande Basin is in a deficit pumping situation of 71,000 and 110,000 acre-feet a year and increasing each year. Noel R. Golahan, a water use management program leader at the Resource Economic Division of the USDA in an article, Water Markets, Implications for Rural Areas of the West, explained that a 20% decline in economic activity is seen when water is transferred from rural areas to developments. The 20% followed the water. This would mean that an area that transferred water rights wouldn't irrigate anymore, wouldn't need gas for their tractors, for hay balers, wouldn't have jobs for people planting and harvesting, they wouldn't use the mill or any processing facilities anymore. There was also a higher rate of outmigration, so people left when they could no longer make a living. This is an example of how land and water use might change a community and in effect change the culture of a community. Danny Sam comes from the Picotes Pueblo. He runs the Bison Project, which works to make the Pueblo more self-sustaining and healthier. I asked him how water has been affected by recent changes.
Well, there again, you know, the land base keeps getting a little bit smaller, and, you know, we're seeing things like pollution in the rivers, and these are from people developing and building homes right along the rivers. And if you look here in the Pueblo, we don't have things developed down to the rivers. There's a zone there where wildlife can still live, you know. There's habitat there along the rivers. It's not completely cleared out. There's willows, there's wild plums, and they're all growing along the riverbanks. In just a few places, you know, there'll be a field maybe that goes up to the river, but it's not developed. There's not houses sitting on it. There's not septic tanks sitting there within 100 feet of the river or even closer. And so those are the kinds of things that we're seeing. People want to build these nice big homes right next to the river. This is the vision they have in their minds when they come here, is living in the mountains and living in this pristine area and being right on the river. Well, that just adds to the pollution. You know, sooner or later, some of these people might end up getting flooded out too, because nature has a way of working against those kind of things.
Esteban Arellano, journalist, tradition bearer, and farmer, explains a cultural clash with water between the Spanish-speaking communities and people who have arrived since the land has become so appealing to people from outside of New Mexico.
You know, but once they buy the land and it remains fallow, in a couple of years, in 5 years, it's going to be full of shiny elm seedlings. And they don't want to cut them because they don't believe in cutting anything. So that land that took so long for my ancestors to really develop and turn into agricultural land is going back to the wild, but not the way it was before with pinon or juniper, but nothing but invasive species. You know, the shiny elms consume huge amounts of water. I've read that they consume about 200 gallons of water a day. And we've got some Chinese elms along the banks of our acequia. And before the water is even running in the acequia, and when you cut those Chinese elms down, right from the center of the tree, the water spouts out like if you had turned on a water hose. So you can imagine how much water those trees are consuming. And when we have a drought, everybody's complaining that there's not enough water. Well, that's one of the reasons we don't have enough water, because all these trees are taking up all the water. But people don't want to cut them. They say, well, that's a way that I've seen the acequia since I moved here. Yeah, but some of them have been here only 10 years, others maybe 5 years, at the most 30 years. That's nothing. You know, the landscape had already started to change. But when I was growing up, I remember the acequias were very different from what they are now, you know. Now we're also having a lot of mayordomos and a lot of commissioners on the acequia that have no clue what they're doing there. But they don't know the community. They don't know the acequia in itself. You know, a mayordomo and a commissioner should know the acequia from the beginning in the presa to the last desagüe, like, you know, the palm of your hand. You have to know every arroyo that runs into the acequia, everything. You know, you have to know where all the beaver dens are, where the muskrats are, or else you're not going to be able to do a very good job, you know.
Peter Vigil from Taos Soil and Water Conservancy District talks a little about the importance of the acequia to northern New Mexican culture. He also said that the newer people offer some hope. Some new people want to do things in a respectful way, working with the community rather than just changing it.
The acequia system is real neat because it allows landowners to put on their boots and get their shovel and go out and do some good physical labor to keep themselves healthy as well as keep the ditch healthy. It allows them to have a community where you talk with other people that are other members of your community on that acequia as you're cleaning it. It allows governments, because the acequia system also has a set of democratic rules. Now, it's not perfect, but it allows all these things that I guess I was taught when I was growing up this part of the country, that we had these certain unalienable rights, right? And the democratic acequia governance was one of those. Being good to the environment, growing your own food, participating in that sort of brings us all together and sort of keeps us close to the land.
I asked Janet Jarrett what it means to be New Mexican.
I'm very proud to be a native New Mexican. I love this state, and I love the land I grew up on, where I'm raising my kids. I love the diversity of people and interests. But most of all, I love the heart the people have. I've been to other states and visited and stuff, but you don't always find that heart for the land and for an area that's diverse. I mean, it's easy to love something because it's beautiful here or it's pretty for now, and anybody can see that. But to love a land in all its changing moods and hard times and good times, that's harder to come by. And I know a lot of people with real heart for their land and their sense of place. And I think that's largely what it means to me to be a New Mexican. And that's the way I view the other New Mexicans I know. There seems to be a big difference between the native New Mexicans and other folks, and it's that heart.
Water is deeply tied to culture. Without it, we couldn't even live. This program was made possible through a grant from the New Mexico Humanities Council in association with the National Endowment for the Humanities, as well as through a grant from the Albuquerque Community Foundation. We would like to thank Jack Rabbit for mailing support, Kit Carson Telecom for internet support, Venado Partners for web design, KRZA Radio, Dusty Yellow Thunder associate producer, and all individuals who gave their time to be interviewed. Theme music was composed and performed by Fidel Gonzalez from El Caballero Aguila Recording Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico. You can hear full interviews and find more information about these issues at www.theshiftofland.org. I'm Sarah Parker. Thank you for listening.